Being Programmed to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica, with your host, Jimmy Fallon Gong.
This is Premium Episode 44, The Cathars Part 2, Cistercian Preaching Missions. Is it okay to be a Luddite in medieval history as parapolitics? Now I realize that discussing an 11th century crusade might seem a bit far afield from my normal topics, which are, of course, business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica. But dear listeners, I want you to know that I am never without a plan. It may not be a good plan, but I have a plan. And I am never not on one about those topics. So just remember that today I am discussing, as best we know, the historical Cathars, not the mindfuck cultic milieu legend of the Cathars. So keep that in mind. Let's get back to the Cathars in order to get to where we're going, because where we're going is where we need to be. Let's get into it. Now, to go back into the Cathars, it might be good to discuss the unique role that literature had with the Cathars. And as you might expect, most Cathar texts were burned by the Catholic Church. The majority of the surviving works were from Italy for a variety of reasons. One is that the Vatican wanted to preserve more of these texts for study, and they grabbed the ones that were nearby. Additionally, literacy was higher in Italy than in France at the time. Also, the Italian Cathars argued more, which led to more polemics. Italy was also closer to Bulgaria than France was, meaning they got much more of that Bogomil, you know, teachings and texts that never made it or survived in France. And of course, the Italian Cathars never faced an apocalyptic invasion of crusaders either. Two books from the East were the Secret Supper text, which goes through the Cathar creation myth. In it, Satan is cast out of heaven for aspiring to be greater than God. On earth, Satan pretends to repent, and so God, I guess tricked, forgives Satan and lets him do what he wants on this earth. And what Satan wants to do, apparently, is to create humanity, putting in each human body the soul of an angel from heaven, right, trapped in clay. It was this trickery which causes God to send Jesus Christ to alert humanity to the existence of God. Now, I know that each and every one of my listeners is a devoted graduate of Catholic catechism, seminary, synagogue, madrasa, things of this nature. I know you're all schooled in the divinities, so I know you would know that this would be considered blasphemous from a Catholic perspective. But aspects of it would be entirely in keeping with certain more Gnostic-inspired religions. Why, yes, including Mormonism, interestingly. Not the Satan part so much, but the human soul part, maybe. Not that I'm saying there's a direct link between Cathars and Mormons. I do not think there is, but nevertheless. Another text important to the Cathars was the Vision of Isaiah, which was a text that explained how reality is being torn apart by the battle between satanic and godly forces, fighting over the souls of humanity. Finally, the most important Cathar tract, as in written by the Cathars themselves, would be the Book of the Two Principles, which was written sometime in the 1240s, which is to say before the Albigensian Crusade. This text shows them innovating their dualistic ideas beyond what the Bogomils believed. It argues that there are two co-eternal principles of good and evil, each corresponding to their respective spheres of heaven and the material world, respectively. The idea that Satan is the god of this world because the true God could not make evil things does have a certain logic to it, I will admit, and it solves, in a way, the problem of theodicy, or why God allows suffering in this world. Finally, there's a text, The Vindication of the Church of God, which lays out why the Cathars, being extremely persecuted, were in fact the true followers of Christ, persecuted by the Antichrist, the Catholic Church. Interesting stuff, right? So, if you'll recall last episode, I mentioned that there were several major missions to the Catholic Church. Several major missions the Catholic Church sent to the Languedoc. Now, we know that these fundamentally did not succeed, and the Albigensian Crusade was the result, then the Inquisition. However, these missions were not nothing. In fact, these missions can teach us a great deal. For the purposes of going through these missions, I am going to read from a PhD dissertation entitled Two Cistercian Preaching Missions to the Languedoc in the 12th Century, 1145 and 1178, by Cicely Dautremont, a dissertation submitted to the faculty of the School of Arts and Sciences of the Catholic University of America in partial fulfillment of the requirements for the degree Doctor of Philosophy. Cicely Dautremont, Washington, D.C., 1984. If you'll recall from the last episode, the first known mention of the Cathars was a letter from the monk Eberwin, who wrote about two different groups of heretics in Cologne. Eberwin wrote how the first group, which is generally understood to be not Cathars, right? They were simply anti-clerical, and they rejected the concept of purgatory and infant baptism. The second group, which was much more concerning to him, was believed to be the Cathars. Eberwin wrote that they belonged to a secret heresy found in Byzantium, that they had their own pope, and that they held the following beliefs. And this is one out of seven. So first, dividing the followers into the elect and the believers. Second, the practice of laying on of hands. The sect was not against baptism as such. Third, the prohibition of marriage and sexual intercourse. Fourth, rejection of a meat diet. Fifth, rejection of the sacraments. Sixth, abolition of property. Seventh, observance of long and frequent fasts. So the dissertation I'm using points out that the letter from Eberwin is regarded as the first real piece of evidence of Cathar dualism in the 12th century, as in the existence of Cathars, right? Now, some of my listeners on the left might have caught the sixth point and might say, abolition of property, that sounds pretty based. And you would be right. For those who believe that the history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggle, the feudal period is a very interesting one, right? Because the feudal period was rife with class struggle. Now, the feudal period is understood to be both a transition period out of various forms of primitive communism. You know, whether or not that term is helpful or not is debatable, but also slave-owning relations, into a form that forced the vast majority of, you know, the population into serf relations with dukes, lords, princes, earls, and kings at the top of society. Then the feudal state gradually transformed through fits and starts into the modern-day wage-labor capitalist system we all know and love. So in a very real sense, the Cathars desiring abolition of property was an understanding or acknowledgement that the very real logic of property was immiserating and forcing these serf relationships. Now, it may or may not have been nuanced or understood that way at the time. Lord knows, I'm certain it was religiously informed too. And I don't know that we can even know that much about their understanding of the abolition of property, but it is a very curious aspect to all this, right? Now, I'll do you one better. The dissertation, as did the books that I cited last episode, pointed out that the Cathar heresy was particularly popular among the ragpickers and weavers of the Languedoc, the early textile industry, in other words. There was a high correlation between these textile centers and the Cathar hotspots, which is impossible to ignore. The dissertation states that the geographical distribution of cloth-making centers in the Languedoc makes interesting reading, although not too much emphasis should be placed on it. It seems nonetheless safe to say that in the 11th and 12th centuries, there was a link between heresy and the textile workers, although it may have expressed itself differently in different regions, unquote. My words here, ragpicking, of course, was used for making paper and clothing, and the weavers were on the forefront of industries that would first become industrialized in the centuries to come. It was these regions that would begin to innovate with mills, factories, weaving machines. And it's interesting, right? Though I do not agree with the dissertation that we should not place too much emphasis on this. Clothing workers were, at that time, 11th century France, a despised class. The cloth industry workers were, in fact, a type of proto-communists, inasmuch as they were workers who were becoming self-aware, becoming aware of their rights and their needs and demands. The dissertation says, "Faceless and nameless, the textors wander on the margins of history during this period, identifying with the social religious doctrines of various local reformers, while bending over their looms or mingling with the crowds of listeners. They risked their lives giving refuge to the slippery Manichaeans. They were blamed for propagating their heretical beliefs among priests and members of the lower clergy, often in the company of loose women. During the 13th and 14th centuries, the weavers vanish from history as important emissaries of heretical dissent," unquote. My words here again. Well, do they vanish from history as important emissaries of heretical dissent? Not according to a one Thomas Ruggles Pynchon, Jr. In his wondrous essay, "Is It Okay to Be a Luddite?" Pynchon lays out the history of the Luddites. And I quote, "Historically, Luddites flourished in Britain from around 1811 to 1816. They were bands of men, organized, masked, anonymous, whose object was to destroy machinery in mostly the textile industry. They swore allegiance not to any British king, but to their own King Lud. It isn't clear whether they called themselves Luddites, although they were so termed by friends and enemies." C.P. Snow, my words here, the guy Pynchon is citing to explain the common use of the term. C.P. Snow's use of the word was clearly polemical, wishing to imply an irrational fear and hatred of science and technology. Luddites had, in this view, come to be imagined as the counter-revolutionaries of the Industrial Revolution, which their modern versions have, quote, "never tried, wanted, or been able to understand," unquote. So, in this essay, Pynchon goes through the actual story of Ned Ludd, who is the man who destroyed weaving machines in 1779, and whose name became the byword for industrial sabotage. Pynchon argues that Luddites have much more than just a knee-jerk reaction to reaction against technology, that Luddites were in fact directly responding to class warfare. And I quote from the essay again, "The knitting machines which provoked the first Luddite disturbances had been putting people out of work for well over two centuries. Everybody saw this happening, became part of daily life. They also saw the machines coming more and more to be the property of men who did not work, only owned and hired. It took no German philosopher, then or later, to point out what this did, had been doing, to wages and jobs. Public feeling about the machines could never have been simple, unreasoning horror, but likely something more complex, the love-hate that grows up between humans and machinery, especially when it's been around a while. not to mention serious resentment towards at least two multiplications of effects that were seen as unfair and threatening. One was the concentration of capital that each machine represented, and the other was the ability of each machine to put a certain number of humans out of work, to be, quote, worth that many human souls. What gave King Lud his special bad charisma, what took him from local hero to national public enemy, was that he went up against these amplified, multiplied, more than human opponents and prevailed. When times are hard and we feel at the mercy of forces many times more powerful, don't we, in seeking some equalizer, turn, if only in imagination, in wish, to the badass, the djinn, the golem, the Hulk, the superhero, who will resist what otherwise would overwhelm us? Of course, the real or secular frame bashing was still being done by everyday folks, trade unionists ahead of their time, using the night and their own solidarity and discipline to achieve their multiplications of effect. It was open-eyed class war. The movement had its parliamentary allies, among them Lord Byron, whose maiden speech in the House of Lords in 1812 compassionately argued against a bill proposing, among other repressive measures, to make frame-breaking punishable by death. "Are you not near the Luddites?" he wrote from Venice to Thomas More. "By the Lord, if there's a row, I'll be among ye. How go on the weavers, the breakers of frames, the Lutherans of politics, the reformers?" He includes an amiable chanson, which proves to be a Luddite hymn so inflammatory that it wasn't published until after the poet's death. The letter is dated December 1816. Byron had spent the summer previous in Switzerland, cooped up for a while in the Via Diodati with the Shelleys, watching the rain come down, while they each all told each other ghost stories. By that December, as it happened, Mary Shelley was working on chapter 4 of her novel Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus. Unquote. So in the essay, Pynchon goes on to discuss Frankenstein, Gothic horror, the Industrial Revolution, the butchery of Auschwitz and Hiroshima, science fiction, and many other topics. Like, you should just straight read the essay. But the essay finally asserts that it is not just okay, but morally right to be a Luddite. And it ends with Lord Byron's poem. "As liberty lads over the sea bought their freedom and cheaply with blood, so we boys, we will die fighting or live free, and down with all kings but King Lud." Now, I bring all this up to explain that heresy as such appears to go deep with the textile industry. Marx famously analyzes commodity production by examining the making of a coat out of linen, right? "I imagine there are all kinds of historical reasons why textiles in particular are such a magnet for these heresies, and I certainly can't nail them all down, but there is something here, man." To return to the Cathars, there were two famous Cathar preachers, Peter of Bruys and Henry of Le Mans. Le Mans, I guess. Peter of Bruys would be lynched by a mob after burning crosses as a show of contempt for the symbol of Christ's sufferings. You know, it's interesting to think of burning crosses in a completely different context from the clan. Of course, the mob did not understand the meaning of burning the cross, and it just looked like outright blasphemy, provoking the lynching, right? The other guy, Henry of Le Mans, also known as Henry of Lausanne, was a popular Cathar preacher who had a debate with an unnamed Catholic priest in 1133. Someone wrote down their whole debate, which gives us the best list of Cathar beliefs. They laid out Henry's seven key tenets of Catharism. They're not going to be all that different from what we've been talking about. First, rejection of original sin. Second, rejection of oil in administration of baptism. Third, prohibition of the consecration of the Eucharist by unworthy priests. Fourth, recognition of the validity of marriage. and divorce without clergy. Fifth, transference of ecclesiastical sacraments to the laymen as priests, which is to say Catholic priests, are unworthy of binding and loosing. Sixth, abolition of benefices and wealth for clergy. Seventh, rejection of church construction. Now that's as good a summation of Cathar beliefs as we're likely to get. And mind you, they are certainly geared towards like the Cathars making their own case, right? So to understand these missions I keep talking about, it's important to understand that we're talking about a feudal society. As such, the counts in all of Europe, not just the Languedoc, did not have a modern day legal system or certain institutions, so they only had so many ways they could solve political problems. The dissertation lists three of the main ways the counts could actually, like, do things. First, by treaties, payments, and ransoms. Second, by alliances through marriage. And third, by compromise, as revealed in their submissions to the papacy and to the civic leaders of Toulouse and the Common Council. So the various forces involved, or different factions, I guess, would be the different serf-peasant groupings, the Catholic Church, the Cathars, such as they were also the civic leaders of Toulouse and various other cities, the network of counts and noblemen who otherwise were like the civil authority. Toulouse's city council in particular was constantly asserting their own rights against the counts and the papacy. They, you know, the city council also had some Cathar sympathies, but also just normal self-interest. And it's interesting to note that as of 1145, Cathars were largely limited to peasants and the weaving classes. Now, we need to talk about the first mission, the mission of Bernard of Clairvaux, which took place in 1145. Bernard of Clairvaux was one of the most important Catholics of the time. He led the Cistercian Order, which was an order of monks that ran a network of monasteries. Like I said, it's kind of like the Franciscans or the, you know, what have you. The Cistercian Order was very important in the Middle Ages. There's a whole genre of architecture, I guess you could say, known as Cistercian architecture all over Europe. They were central to the development of several innovations in agriculture and hydraulic engineering, which is to say the early development of water wheels for mills and so forth. Which is to say the Cistercian Order was in some ways kind of like a proto-corporation leading in industrial production. Crucial to this was the fact that the orders, all of them, didn't pay taxes, which of course spurred their growth. In the Knights Templar episode that I did with Monty, Monty explained how Bernard of Clairvaux was a key propagandist for the Crusades and a popularizer for the Knights Templar. He would be one of the key men to push for the Crusades. There's this famous scene, right, in history, where Bernard shouts a sermon to a huge, gigantic crowd full of thousands and thousands of Frenchmen. And I quote, "O ye who listen to me, hasten to appease the anger of heaven, but no longer implore the goodness by vain complaints. Clothe yourself in sackcloth, but also cover yourselves with your impenetrable bucklers. The din of arms, the danger, the labors, the fatigues of war are the penances that God now imposes upon you. Hasten then to expiate your sins by victories over the infidels, and deliverance of the holy places be the reward of your repentance." Unquote. And of course, this provoked cries of Deus vult, God wills it. And of course, Bernard would shout, "Cursed be he who does not stain his sword with blood." Just getting everybody hyped as hell to go do some freaking crusades. So Bernard of Clairvaux made that speech in 1146, before the Second Crusade would be launched. Before that, in 1145, a year before, he went on the mission to the Languedoc to deal with the Cathar heresy. Interesting, right? So the dissertation that I'm continually citing says the two preaching missions launched by the abbots of Clairvaux and other concerned ecclesiastics in 1145 and 1178 were widely different in character, motivation, and composition. In 1145, Bernard was already 55 years old. By now he was a seasoned hunter of heretics, having successfully and mercilessly banished Arnold of Brescia from France and destroyed Arnold's mentor, the liberal-thinking but unheretical Peter Abelard, who Bernard darkly suspected of collaborating with Arnold to construct a new faith in Europe. Unquote. Side note here, that's Peter Abelard of Abelard and Eloise, the famous monk and nun who, I want to say Abelard was like smashing Eloise back before, and then like, I think he got like castrated and forced to become a monk, and then they wrote terribly romantic yet restrained like letters for the rest of their lives to each other about like God or something. Anyway, Bernard of Clairvaux suspected him of heresy, which is funny. Also, my words here, if you think about it, hunting heresies is kind of like counterintelligence. Is it not? You're dealing with ideology, with deception, with people hiding their true motives and beliefs. And more often than not, you're doing something immoral yourself, right? So, the dissertation says, In the year following the mission to the Languedoc, Bernard would expend enormous energies on a preaching campaign in support of the Second Crusade, a dream dear to his heart, but disastrous in consequence. His energies were not limited to the diplomatic negotiations or preaching holy wars, however. Thanks to his influence, the Cistercian order expanded in a manner that can only be described as phenomenal. One writer notes, at his death in 1153, Bernard would be the father of 70 communities, besides those which were affiliated by them. Unquote. So, we know a lot about Bernard's mission because he wrote extensively about this preaching mission. He wrote about attacking the foxes, which was his term for heretics. Foxes, of course, because foxes spoil the vineyards of God's kingdom on earth. We know pretty much down to the day where he was and what he was doing, which is remarkable to have that kind of record, you know, in the early Middle Ages. What's more, Bernard of Clairvaux, also known as Saint Bernard, because he was canonized in 1174, on this preaching mission, he performed miracles. Like, we're talking healing of the sick, restoring sight to the blind, raising donkeys from the dead, and exorcisms. So some pretty high-grade miracles. Now, here's where this dissertation had me vibrating on a higher frequency, and I quote, although principally intended as a mission against heresy, Bernard's participation in it may have had other motives. The Cistercian expansion in the Languedoc was in its beginning phase, and it seems that Bernard was keenly interested in expediting its progress. Here it need only be observed that there were opportunities for lodging in hospitable abbeys and daughter houses all along the route, where Bernard could ponder the expansion of his order while continuing his leisurely pursuit of his sworn enemy, Henry, the renegade monk and vile apostate. Bernard was everywhere at once, terrorizing his enemies, encouraging his friends, popes, monarchs, statesmen, abbots, already laying plans to beat the drum for the next great catastrophe in the Holy Land. Bernard's journey to the Languedoc failed to eliminate the heresy. There is indeed evidence that the number of heretics increased in the years following his mission. Although Bernard expressed some hopeful sentiments about the results of his mission in his letter to the people of Toulouse, he was guarded in his prognostications. Unquote. Now, the evidence for this is pretty strong. Basically, like I said, we know where Bernard of Clairvaux went during this entire mission. I go back to the dissertation. Quote, what clues are there that Bernard's mission may have had a conscious secondary purpose such as this? Bernard's itinerary may provide one hint. His journey from Clairvaux included stops at Poitiers, Bordeaux, Bergerac, and Sarlat. Bernard planned to follow in Henry's footsteps to dispel his bad influence. The incorporation of Grandselve, however, raises the question of a possible secondary motive for Bernard's mission. The journey to Languedoc may have been used in connection with, or even as pretext for, plans to colonize the recently recovered frontier land, New Catalonia, in northeastern Spain between Lérida and Tortosa. At the same time, the mission provided a useful opportunity to secure the religiously weak spots of the western Languedoc. Unquote. To make that more clear, Bernard's mission involved following wherever Henry Le Mans went and preaching there. But he made a big detour to Grandselve, where Henry did not go, and then he did not write about preaching there, which is a curious omission. Quote, in conclusion, it seems safe to say that the expansion of Clairvaux into the Languedoc from 1143 to the 1160s is a demonstration of Bernard's charisma and single-minded devotion to the order. By attaching the eremitical communities of Gerard of Sale, he allowed these fringe houses, which might have fallen into decay, to survive under the economic and ecclesiastical privileges of the Cistercian exemptions. He perceived the enormous potential of Grandselve and Fontfroid for the Midi as bastions of heresy and as pioneers in Reconquista Spain. In 1145, Clairvaux was already a force to be reckoned with. By 1160, Clairvaulian monasteries dotted the landscape, whiter than the sheep in high pastures of the Pyrenees Orientales. Had Bernard been alive that year, he might have turned his eyes toward heaven and murmured with the ghost of a smile, "Mission accomplished." Unquote. Except, of course, the mission of extinguishing the Cathar heresy, which was not accomplished, right? Nevertheless, this is wild, right? An examination of the parapolitical implications of a Cistercian preaching mission in 12th century. Sure enough, there is evidence to believe that it was cover for the expansion of what were basically Middle Ages-style corporate interests into the region. Very, very interesting. So the second mission occurred in 1178, and it was a much more tense affair. This mission was led by Henry of Marcy, a Cistercian abbot. I know Henry was the renegade monk the first time, but what are you going to do, right? So this mission came upon the request of Raymond V, the father of Raymond VI, the guy that got excommunicated like five times that we talked about last episode. Raymond V was getting worried about the growth of the heresy. While in 1145 the Cathars were largely limited to the peasant and weaver classes, this time in 1178 much of the entire city of Toulouse held to the Cathar faith. In a letter that Raymond V wrote, he said, "The filth of heresy is becoming intolerable, a veritable sewer of filth and disease," and he suggested that a preaching mission might not be enough. That's what got Henry of Marcy to go on a preaching mission, accompanied by some 300 men, which is huge, right? This was less a preaching mission like Bernard of Clairvaux and much closer to an Inquisition type of thing. They basically did do investigations, which lasted for 6 to 8 weeks, and surprise, surprise, everybody hated them. I quote from the dissertation again, "The spiritual condition of Toulouse looked critical upon entering the city. The members of the commission were greeted with derision and open contempt by many of the townspeople, heretics and sympathizers, who jeered at them and made insulting gestures. The critical point of the mission's history was Henry of Marcy's decision to turn persecution of heretics into a just war within a Christian country. He crafted some of the decretals for holy war and persecution of heretics onto the older stocks of Bernardine and pre-Bernardine theory," unquote. Now this is very interesting because Henry of Marcy is building on Bernard of Clairvaux's legal theories about just war in relation to the Crusades. which is something that would have grave consequences for the rest of world history. In relation to this, they relied on Bernard's three-point plan for dealing with heresies, which is, first, they should be taken not by arms, but by arguments by which their errors are refuted. If this can be done, they will be reconciled as Catholics called back to the true faith. Second, they should advise the church faithful to drive away or even imprison the unregenerate heretic who has refused to be reconciled after two admonitions. Third, better to restrain the foxes by the sword than permit them to draw others into their errors. The last one, of course, being the express condoning of war against a population, if that was not clear. The dissertation says, "The turning point in papal attitudes toward the South came with the rule of Pope Lucius III and the papal bull Ad Abolendum, which came in 1184. In the bull, the Pope charged the bishops personally to begin a search and destroy policy on heretics. If the bishops were unable to undertake the task, they were to commission others to do it for them. They were to weed out the penitents from the lapsed, and if spiritual remedies failed, to turn over the unregenerate to the secular arm for punishment. After 1184 and the Council of Verona, the papacy moved quickly and effectively to contain and abolish the heretical threat, blazing the trail for holy war in southern France and its grim aftermath." The dissertation ends saying, "Henry of Marcy continued Bernard's preaching tradition, though in a different fashion and for a different purpose. He earned the distinction of being the first to call for a crusade in the Languedoc. In effect, war against the enemies of the church in a Christian country. This appeal for a just war against heretics carried over to the Third Lateran Council, which incorporated among its canons a decree which called for a crusade against the heretics. 5 years later, at the Council of Verona, Lucius III promulgated the bull, ordering bishops or their representatives to, first, visit parishes suspected of harboring heretics once or twice a year, second, to initiate proceedings against anyone previously denounced by sworn witnesses, and third, to judge and punish as heretics anyone who refused to take the oath to denounce suspected heretics. All of these signs were integral to the inevitable outbreak of the Holocaust following the assassination of Peter of Castelnau. What Bernard began, Henry completed. In his end was his beginning." Unquote. And we know the rest of the story. 20,000 massacred in one city alone, somewhere between 200,000 and 1 million dead in the Languedoc total. The first European genocide, the repression of the Cathar faith, and the innovation of the Inquisition. All history is bloody history. Now, in discussing the history of the Cathars, we are touching on a number of very, very interesting things. For one, we're talking about weavers, early textile workers, proto-communists, and their connection to heresies, whether Cathar, Luddite, or Marxist. No, I am not suggesting those three are particularly related, except that they each, in varying amounts, involve workers becoming aware, asserting their rights, and fighting back. Not for nothing are textile workers a recurring hotbed of heresy. Now, the dissertation I keep referring to examines the likelihood of the Cistercian order as cover for the growth of the Cistercian order as a whole. We know that the Albigensian Crusade was also an attempt to colonize southern France and northern Spain, to resettle it. There is a curious yet realistic idea that the Cistercians were in some ways casing the joint, something we know they did on behalf of imperial powers in foreign countries later, right? Like, the Jesuits would, like, go in there, preach, do some teaching, and be looking around at what isn't bolted to the ground that they could steal later. And I'm telling you, imperialism's roots were grown at home. it happened there first, actually. Yes, it always comes back, but it started here too. Then, on top of that, this dissertation I keep referring to, which examined the Cistercian missions, it specifically frames it as a form of primitive counterinsurgency. This is very curious. We will revisit this dissertation in the next episode. For sources today, of course, I used the books The Cathars, The Most Successful Heresy of the Middle Ages by Sean Martin, The Cathars, The Perfect Heresy by Stephen O'Shea, The Friar of Carcassonne, Revolt Against the Inquisition in the Last Days of the Cathars by Stephen O'Shea, and, of course, this 1984 dissertation, to be discussed more fully next week. Now, thank you for listening, dear listeners. So just tell a friend about the show. I'm very thankful for all the support. Just let your friends know how great Program to Chill is. I need to be on my way to Georgetown. See you next week, and God bless.